Hey friends, welcome to Movie Crush. This is Charles W. Chuck Bryant coming to you from the studio here in Atlanta, Georgia at Ponce City Market, where during the day I am co-host of Stuff You Should Know, and at night I dim the lights, and turn on the projector, and get Movie Crush going. This week in the studio we have, well, in his studio and me in my studio. This is a remote session, but we have Mr. Roman Mars. Roman is the host of 99% Invisible, which is one of the not only greatest podcasts of all time, but one of the greatest pieces of culture that this country has to offer. I'm going to go ahead and say that. Roman is a great guy. He is also the mastermind and head chief of Radiotopia, which is one of the great, great podcast networks out there. They host some of my favorite shows on the web. And I met Roman, through email probably 6 or 7 years ago. I met Roman before 99% Invisible was a thing, when Roman was a producer and employee of PRX, and he was a fan of Stuff You Should Know and got in touch with Josh and myself and said, "Hey guys, how would you like Stuff You Should Know to be on public radio?" And we said, "Well, we think that's kind of a neat idea." And we took a couple of calls with him and talked about it quite a bit. And in between the time we talked about getting the show going on public radio, Roman went along and created 99% Invisible. And we never heard from him again. Actually, that's not quite true. But that became his primary job. And then he created Radiotopia. And we clearly knew that if we wanted to get on public radio, that we had to go a different route, because Roman was now a superstar of the medium, and rightfully so. And we've been so happy for his success over the years. He's just one of the great dudes in the world, a super nice guy. You really won't meet a better person in this podcasting industry or entertainment industry than Mr. Roman Mars. So obviously he has his own studio out there in California, like we said, and I got in touch with Roman as one of my first guests because he's a pal, and we have similar sensibilities. And Roman did not take long to pick out Jaws as his favorite movie. And I got super excited the instant he said that, because this is, I know we're only a few episodes in, but this is the first time that, even though I did love Let the Right One In, and I liked Tron, Jaws, I've often called my favorite movie of all time. It sort of vacillates between several different films. But in my blog post that I did a few years ago, where I listed my top 100 movies in the Stuff You Should Know blog, I did put Jaws that week as my favorite movie of all time. Released in 1975, obviously directed by a very young and up-and-coming Steven Spielberg. This is the movie that really put him on the map. Written, I think he had a part in writing the screenplay, although officially I don't see him listed as one of the writers. I see Peter Benchley obviously wrote the book that was released the year before. It was a sort of a smash hit summer beach reader, which is kind of ironic, and captured the public's attention in book form first. And then Benchley and a man named Carl Gottlieb wrote the screenplay. I have heard over the years that Spielberg did write on the screenplay as well. So even though he's not officially listed in the credits as such, I think he did have something to do with it. This is back when Spielberg was writing more. But at any rate, it stars the great Roy Scheider, the great, great Richard Dreyfuss, and the great Robert Shaw as sort of the three-headed protagonist of this film, battling the killer shark. I remember being a kid and thinking the shark's name was Jaws. A very young child, I think I was, what would I have been, 4 or 5 years old when it came out. And but it even captured my attention as a kid that young. That's how big of a pop culture phenomenon this movie was. Obviously, spoilers are going to abound, but if you haven't seen Jaws by now, then God have mercy on your soul is all I have to say. It has been called a horror film in some circles. In fact, on a recent Stuff You Should Know, 10 Horror Movies That Changed the Genre, we even talk about Jaws a little bit, although I have always maintained that Jaws is an adventure film more than anything else, even though it does have some pretty terrifying elements. At the end of the day, for me, it's an adventure film and one of the great, great movies of all time. So it's going to be interesting to talk to Roman, because I've seen this movie so many times. It is weird, to be honest. I've seen this movie more times than people should probably see a single movie, but I think Roman is in the same boat. So it should be pretty interesting to see how two diehard Jaws veterans, think about this movie and kind of what it means. Cause I know Roman watched it last night and I watched it today. So what it means after all these repeated viewings, should be fairly interesting to see where we land on that. So, don't want to keep you in suspense any longer. We're going to get that shark out of the water and onto the boat. And coming up in 1, 2, or 3 seconds, Jaws with Roman Mars. I did see on Facebook that you posted that you watched Jaws last night for about the 30th time.
I did, yeah. I just wanted to bone up, you know, just make sure I remembered all the parts. And it's a funny, well, I don't want to start now, but yeah, it's, I just wanted to, I can't go in. I'm an over-preparer. I'm just a producer at heart. I can't help it. So,
well, it's funny because I watched about 90% of it 2 weeks ago because, you know, it's one of those things, and probably for you too, it's one of those movies. If you're flipping it around at night and catch it, it's hard to turn that channel. So totally. I watched about 90% of it, and then I still watched it today before I came in all the way through because I realized I hadn't made notes or anything. And as much as I know the movie, I was like, yeah, I'm kind of like you. I was like, I should probably scribble down some things just, you know, since I'm in the sort of the driver's seat here. I need to be a pro.
Cool.
But before we get into Jaws, though, I kind of wanted to ask you just a little bit about the your kind of general movie fandom growing up. Where are you from, California?
No, I was born in New Jersey, and in the early part of my life, probably the first time I really went to see movies, I was living in North Carolina and South Carolina, in the South.
So you moved around then?
I did. I moved around a lot. I didn't move to California until I was in my mid-20s.
Okay. And you and I both lived in Athens, Georgia, I think.
We did.
A little bit at the same time, right?
I think so. I lived there from 94 to 97. I was in graduate school there.
Okay. I went 89 to 95, so we overlapped for about a year.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a fun place. I haven't been back since I left. I miss it, but I left under such dire circumstances.
Oh, really?
Breakups and weird friendships dissolving and everything. And so, like, I've been scared away for years, but I think enough time has passed now that it's been, you know, almost 20 years, I think, or over 20 years, I think, you know, it's, I think I'm safe.
Yeah. So. I think a lot of people have had that experience where they see the town in their rearview mirror and you're like, I'm never coming back.
But I loved it. I really did.
Yeah.
I loved all these aspects of it. I thought, you know, in many ways I could stay there forever.
Sure.
Which is a bit of a syndrome of people who live in Athens.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
but I loved, you know, the taco stand and the grit and going to the 40 watt. I mean, I loved it so much that it was kind of a problem when I was in graduate school because I was one of the graduate students who, like, always went out and saw shows, and my friends were, you know, were residents and not graduate students. And so it always kind of pulled me in a lot of different directions.
I feel pretty sure if we compared show notes from 94 and 95 that we were at a lot of the same shows.
I would not doubt it. It's totally true. I mean, I went to, at that time I was, you know, convinced A, that I was going to start my own record label.
Yeah.
B, that I could not survive in a place that didn't have at least two shows a week that I wanted to go to.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I was convinced. And one of the reasons why I left graduate school was I had all these friends because the, you know, postdoc fellowships were so competitive that they, you know, if they had to go to some place, some tiny town and do their postdoc, they just had to, because there's like 100, 200 people applied for it. And if they're lucky enough to get it, they just had to take it. And I just couldn't stand to have, you know, my life controlled by that.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be someplace where I could, you know, like, go see punk bands. I mean, it was just like, it was everything to me. And if you would have told me I was just a lame middle-aged guy now, who just like it barely can go out, you know, like on like a good night can barely go out to see anybody.
I know.
I would be very shocked by it, but it meant everything to me.
Yeah. I still try to go to shows as much as possible. And it helps when there are the venues that have, decent starting times, you know, but some of the,
yeah, exactly.
There's a couple of the clubs here in Atlanta that's still like, the band's going to go on at midnight. And I just, you know how it is. Yeah. I can't do that.
Yeah. Can't do that. No, I do think that there's a, you know, like a designed experience where if a venue really wanted to be very, very good for all ranges of people and like really start on time, really publish when everyone starts, do all that stuff.
Yeah.
I feel like you would attract a really loyal clientele.
Totally.
If you did that. But that's just not the way those places work.
Yeah. I mean, I feel lucky if I can get start times.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know,
so there's like, so now I go like, if I know someone, you know, and I feel like it's like, oh yeah, it'll be nice to see that person and stuff like that. But I don't do exploratory, you know, here's a band on a label that I like.
Yeah,
I
which was
home that well.
In the Athens days,
it
was so great. You could go to the 40 watt on a blurb from the flagpole for $5 on a Thursday night and
totally.
Have your mind blown.
Yeah. And that I miss. I miss that a lot.
Me too. We should get rid of these kids and move back to Athens.
We should just follow around punk fans around the country.
So your movie going experience though was largely like when were your kind of early teen years? Is that North Carolina?
Early teen years would have been Ohio, actually. So I moved to Ohio in third grade.
Okay,
and so that would be the time when I. You know, I could probably go to movies on my own with a friend, you know,
yeah.
to be dropped off, see things. We had no real policy at my house in terms of whether or not I could watch R-rated movies or whatever. I could watch whatever.
Lucky you.
I worked my cousin in Memphis, who I spent summers with, she owned a video store.
Uh-huh.
And I worked in the video store all summer long as a sort of unpaid teen, you know, like underage employee. And so I would watch movies all the time there and take movies home. But then I would, you know, I would go see, I mean, I don't know if my movie taste is like all that different than what it was when I was a teen. I just had a lot of access to, I really fell in love with like kind of older 70s movies.
Yeah.
At the period when I was going to the video store a lot or working at the video store a lot. And so I think of movies, I don't think of movies as things in a theater. I think of those VHS boxes and the box art. That's my, if you were to say, do you like movies? That's the picture I have is that rather than a movie theater.
Yeah. That's funny, man, because my grandparents and my mom are from Memphis and I would spend a lot of summers, not full summers in Memphis with my grandparents. So I think you and I were constantly crossing paths, it seems like, over the years. What part of Ohio
were
they
live in? Memphis? What town? What part of town?
Oh, in Memphis?
Yeah.
They had a house in Germantown.
No shit. Really?
Yeah.
Like, that's literally where I lived, in Germantown.
That's so funny. What if, like, well, yeah. I didn't get out much. Like, you know, when you go to the grandparents' house, there's just a lot of staying in. So that's kind of mainly what
yeah.
I did. But
no, my aunt lived in Germantown, and my cousin lived with her on and off different times.
So funny.
And the video store was in Germantown. They didn't move in. They moved to Midtown in Memphis
uh-huh.
you know, later on. So I got to know Midtown. But yeah, it was all Germantown. It's crazy.
What part of Ohio?
Central Ohio. It was Newark is kind of outside Columbus. So
uh-huh.
it's a small, you know, industrial town, very depressed. I don't know what's going on there these days.
But, right.
But I would go into Columbus to have my sort of culture, but you could be dropped off at Indian Mound Mall and watch a movie and that was okay. And there was still like a dollar theater kind of nearby my house, like a second run theater, which is
right.
That's the, if of all the, you know, movie things that I get nostalgic for, it's probably the existence of second run theaters, which don't really happen much here in the Bay Area. That's not a thing. you know, like cheap theaters.
Yeah, I think there probably is still one in Atlanta. When I grew up, though, I'm the same as you. There was one, a 99-cent movie near Northlake Mall, and I think it had two screens. And we went there because Second Run, I don't know how it's done these days, but it's not like Second Run was that far behind First Run.
Totally. Not at all. Yeah, we had my, where I lived in Chicago, more when I was an adult, there was, I lived in Logan Square and there was a Logan Theater. It was a Second Run theater. We used to call it Logan's Second Run. And, and it was a great place. Like it's when my kids were born, when I lived in that apartment. And so I could just, I just would walk over and I'd watch anything for like a couple bucks just to get out of the house, you know?
Yeah. Cause they're more than a dollar now, right?
Yeah. I think they were maybe, it might've been three or something, but it was like in this great neighborhood and they put out popcorn and, or that you could get popcorn and they always had hot sauce for your popcorn, which is which is a real great Latino neighborhood sort of, perk, you know? And so I would get a bag of popcorn and put a bunch of, hot sauce on it and then eat it in the theater. That was a great place.
That's funny because the 99-cent theater, I remember they had a huge stack of pennies and it was, you know, they didn't round up. They would slide the penny and your ticket stub across. And I always thought that was kind of a nice touch. That wasn't lost on me even as like a 12-year-old.
Oh, that's hilarious. That's hilarious.
So do you remember your first, I mean, you might as well get into Jaws. Do you remember the first time you saw that? I imagine it was on VHS.
It was. I definitely saw Jaws on VHS because I was born in 74. So, it probably lasted and came back in the theaters while I was, you know, cognizant and going to movies. And I was taken to movies that were wholly inappropriate when I was a kid.
Right.
My first movie memory is going to see Blue Lagoon. Maybe as a 4 or 5 year old. And then I saw, Star Trek, the motion picture, which is almost more inappropriate for a child of that. I was so bored. I just remember like being kind of into it visually, but just being so bored.
It's a pretty slow movie.
Yeah. So I definitely saw Jaws in a combination of like VHS and also, by the time I was 13 or so, I had a little 13-inch TV in my bedroom and I, you know, and it was on, you know, cable was expanding and it was on TBS probably, you know, like every couple of weeks or every couple of days or something. And it's such a weirdly complex movie. I mean, I don't say complex. It's more like it has all these scenes in it that you don't remember. Like it's just this richness of scenes and moments that when you think about Jaws, you think about the whole last section where they're on the ocean.
Right.
But there's a whole hour where they're not, you know?
Yeah.
And so you would catch it at different times and you're like, wow, I don't remember this at all, you know? And I feel like I saw bits and pieces of it like that and, you know, learned to fall in love with every aspect of it, not just, you know, a dude being chomped in half.
Right.
And that's when I really fell in love with it, probably more on TV than anything else.
Yeah. Same here. I mean, I was, about 3 years older than you. So I was old enough to where I remember, and it ran forever in the movie theaters. It was back then when, you know, they would tout like, you know, 400 days in and stuff like that in the ads, which is just crazy to think about now. But I remember it being a pop culture phenomenon. And I remember, obviously I wasn't allowed to see it because I had a kind of different deal growing up Southern Baptist. I was way sheltered and my parents tried to keep me from indulging in anything that was good and cool. I remember being, you know, 5 years old and knowing Jaws was a thing, seeing the book mainly on shelves and that huge, ridiculously huge shark on the book in the poster and, knowing that music and obviously being a little Baptist boy, being very titillated by that opening sequence of the, the, you know, shadowy naked lady. right. That's why when you said Blue Lagoon, I still had a little like shiver that went up my spine because that movie as a young boy was like, oh my goodness. It's like the dirtiest thing ever. It is probably very tame looking back. I haven't seen
it. I've never revisited it, but my guess is it's totally tame.
Yeah. So Jaws, I remember it being a thing. I remember it being out in the news, and I remember it scaring me to go in the ocean, even though I hadn't even seen the movie at that point.
Yeah, I feel like I think my fear of it predated my real exposure to it as well.
Yeah.
I think and it was so pervasive that I was the same, you know, when my one family member who lived in Germantown had a pool, and I'd be scared of the pool.
You know, me too.
Which is insane.
Yeah, I had the same experience.
And so
it made us scared of water.
Exactly. Which is just absurd. And so it was real visceral. I mean, that fear of nature in that way just is crazy, and you just can't outrun it. It's just nuts. And when I was talking to my boys about watching it and how it's my favorite movie, and they know it's my favorite movie, and they're like, when can we watch it? And I'm like, I don't know, never. Why don't you just like live, you know, like, I know it's great, and maybe when you decide that you can do it yourself and you can buy your own, you know, like when you have your own Amazon accounts that you can watch it. But I feel like I would just be paying for it forever, you know, while they're in my house.
Yeah. How old are they?
I let them watch Jaws. They're 10. I have twin boys who are 10.
Oh, that's about the age, Roman. You might need them into Jaws.
I know. It's definitely time, and they're into it, but I love everything about it. I mean, the thing about the movie, and I figured out later on, you know, in addition to like it, you know, like it having like a real, like it has a real primal, response in me.
Mm-hmm.
I think of it as the best horror movie almost ever made. I think it's the best adventure movie. I think it is the best buddy comedy.
Yeah.
And it's all put together in this way that you never get whiplash as to what moment you're in at any moment. It is so well done. It makes you realize why it is fueled, you know, 40 years of horrible blockbusters that followed, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, I think of it as being that good that your memory of it is the setting the table for what a big summer movie was is I find it just transcendent and how good it is.
Well, yeah, there's no, and in watching it again today and last week, as an adult, the sense of it being an adventure movie really comes through a lot more, than, you know, when I was a kid, it was way more just like terrifying. But even like the soundtrack and the score from John Williams, it does have the scary bit that everyone remembers, that iconic, you know, ba-dump, ba-dump. But most of the score of that movie is this very exuberant, uplifting adventure music.
You know? And it happens in these great moments, and you just like, it'll be really scary, and then it'll be like, you know, like, and they're chasing it, and it's just like, it's totally amazing. It turns on a dime, and it's really effective. It's one of my favorite scores. I would never like listen to it on its own or anything, but
right,
just as a compliment to a movie, it does amazing things.
Yeah. And the other thing that kind of hit home to me was how little, I will say almost zero fat there is in the movie. It's just so tight. And I think it still has a running time of a couple of hours. But it never drags. There's not a single scene, and this is why I end up watching it so much, if I happen to turn it on, there's not a single scene or sequence in that movie that doesn't draw me in.
Totally. I think that if you want to study how to, you know, set a scene and present the densest amount of information in the most pleasant way,
the beginning
where Brody is going around the island without him really saying anything explicit, without it seeming like exposition, there's like these snatches of dialogue where everyone's kind of complaining about, you know, the karate class, you know, chopping through his picket fences. And then there's the guy who's trying to, you know, get him to do him a favor because of real estate or something. And then there's all this stuff that's happening. And they're like, you don't know the whole story. It's like little sections of a story, but you get a real sense of what's going on. And it's just brilliant. I don't know how they did it all. And you don't really see that in movies this way, you know, that way anymore. I was pretty amazed at it when I was looking at it the most recent time. It's like a stunning amount of exposition that's always interesting. And it really does the job of making you understand what Amity is.
I got the same exact feeling, watching it today, is that it's, like you said, setting up that world, it was done in such a subtle and efficient way. I feel like movies these days, everything is just so ham-fisted with the setups and so obvious. Even just the little part about establishing that Brody and Ellen have moved there from New York to, it's Amity Island, but ostensibly, you know, the New England area. And these days there would be some stupid long scene where they talked about, or maybe even, God forbid, like a flashback that actually shows them in New York or something. And they did it all with just that one little exchange where she talks about the accent and, you know, pocking the ka from the yod. And that's how we have to talk. And she said something about, you know, you being from New York. And that was it. And to a novice eye or someone who's not a big Jaws fan, it just may seem like a little throwaway line. But to guys like us, we're just like, oh man, it's just so subtle and efficient the way that world is set up.
Everything. It's like really subtle, really efficient. Everything. It's like nothing is wasted, but it never feels rushed. And there are real quiet, beautiful moments that are just stunning. Like him at the dinner table with his son.
Oh, God.
That feels like that would be cut from a movie today.
Yep.
There's these, the way that the dialogue feels very real. Like, you know, there's after they have a horrible day and Mrs. Kittner slaps Brody on the face and he's drinking and Hooper comes in and says, so how was your day? And it's the funniest line. Like, it's just like, it's so great. And I feel like there's just this subtlety and real understanding of how humans are in that movie that I just don't see. And I don't get it. Like, sometimes you could be doing these things and not do them well, and I would be annoyed and bored in a movie.
Yeah.
So it's not like you can just put them in willy-nilly, these moments, but I just think every one of them is pitch perfect. I just love it.
Yeah. I have to address both of those things, because those are that sequence from, the sequence from Kittner's mom, which is so upsetting, because I have a big justice thing, and the injustice of Brody being blamed for that, standing right next to the mayor, whose fault it really was, and the mayor just like a coward standing there. And of course, afterward he says, you know, it's not your fault, Brody, but Brody says
it's his fault. And I actually think he's right. You know, like he owns it, you know, like he could have stood up and he knows it, and it sort of gives him motivation for the rest of the movie.
It's absolutely.
Like, you know what? You know, like, I'm the chief of police. You know, like, he's like, let's go cut up that shark. And it's like, well, can you do that? Like, I'm the chief of police. You know, like that.
Such a great line.
It's like he's finding his, like, he's finding his authority in this scenario. And I feel like, you know, like, you know, never so dramatically, but I feel like that sense of his responsibility stayed with me. You know, I think that's a great lesson in just life, is that it doesn't matter. You can blame all sorts of other people, but ultimately you just take it sometimes.
Well, because that was Brody's chance to be a whiny baby and say,
I know
it wasn't my fault, but he owned
it.
And then that scene, of course, leads right into the pre-dinner scene with the son that you were talking about. And like you said, I timed it today too. It's a 90-second scene that, by all accounts these days, like you said, would be on the editing room floor. But it is one of my, just that little 90 seconds is one of my favorite scenes in movie history, for real.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh,
it's
totally.
Just so sweet.
It is really sweet. It gives you a sense of who he is. And his family. And it also gives you a sense of like, of now I'm a parent, and it has one of the, I mean, even before I was a parent, like, it's really hard to understand what kids do to you when you have them.
Yeah.
And how much they mean to you. And in these weird ways, like where you need them to buoy you up really, really often in the day, as hard as they are, and, you know, as difficult as it all is. And like, I rely on my kids in much the same way that Brody does.
Sure.
In that scene. And then like, give me a kiss. And says, why? So, cause I need it. And yeah. I feel like that almost every day.
I know, man. I'm right there with you. And it's funny. I lift so many lines. I'm, you know, one of those obnoxious people that goes around quoting movie lines for like half their, like half the things I say are probably from movies. And I realized that I say so many things from Jaws, and one of them is give us a kiss. I say that to my daughter all the time. And, you know, the scene with Dreyfus when he comes in every time without fail. And my wife, Emily, gets so bored with all this stuff, but every time I go somewhere and someone opens up a bottle of wine and pours a glass, I always say, oh, you might want to let that breathe for a minute. It's just so dumb. And like 2% of the people I ever say it in front of know what that's from. And the other 98% just think I'm being obnoxious, I guess. But that scene, there's so many great lines. In that dinner scene, everything from my husband tells me you're in Sharks to the end of the scene, I can do anything. I'm chief of police. Like, those are just iconic movie lines.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely full of those. It's so good. And it also feels real. Like, it doesn't feel, they're not overly clever. They're not delivered in a clever way.
It's totally,
just, it just feels natural. And as funny as it would be in those moments, and as heavy as they would be in those moments. So.
Well, and the scene that kind of follows that is also one of my favorites, which is when, and I have to point out too, by the way, the mayor was played by Murray Hamilton, the great Murray Hamilton, as Mayor Vaughn, who was Mr. Robinson in The Graduate, was his other
kind of
a huge film role. But, we were talking about how subtly Spielberg set up the world. In the first time we see the mayor, he's wearing that sport coat with the anchors on it. And just that little wardrobe choice was just such a nice way. Like, he didn't even have to say anything. You just see that guy show up in that outfit and you know who he is.
Yeah, totally.
But,
yeah, and his smile and everything. Yeah. It's, really
but the, after the wreckage scene, after Dreyfus, after Hooper does the dive, and finds the shark tooth and the head bobs out. They have that great scene with in front of the billboard with the mayor and Brody. And I knew you would appreciate this. I've always thought that Sick Vandalism would be a great name for a punk band. Sick Vandalism.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, that's so what good. He's upset about still.
That's what he's upset about, yeah. That would be a good name. I wonder if that has ever been taken.
I don't know. Google that junk.
It's time.
So from there, obviously in the movie, it moves on to, like, everyone has their turning point. And I think with Brody, it was definitely, like you said, when, Kintner's mom, who, slaps him in the face, that was where he turned. But then, Mayor Vaughn had his turning point too after that, that final, you know, 4th of July when he forced 4th of July to happen. Well, not 4th of July, but he kept the beaches open. Well, let's talk a little bit about these characters. You probably know your Jaws trivia, but did you know all the various people who originally were supposed to play these dudes?
No, I don't. I don't know a lot of Jaws trivia. It's not something I've really looked up or anything like that. Hit me.
Get a load of this then. Chief Brody originally was supposed to be played by Robert Duvall. But he only wanted to play Quint.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Robert Duvall could probably have pulled off both of those. Like, I'm glad he didn't, but but definitely he could have done Brody at that age. He could have done Brody for sure.
Well, Charlton Heston he was the other pick for Brody, which, Spielberg apparently didn't go with him just because he was too big for that role.
I wouldn't go with him. Too big and like, you could, you know, it's like casting Schwarzenegger in something. It's like, okay, I know you're going to. Yeah. I know you're going to Hulk out any minute. So let's just, you know, so you need someone who's like, who you can see his strength, but it's hidden, you know. So,
well, Scheider brought such a humanity to that role.
He did, and and one of my other, kind of favorite '70s movies is Marathon Man. And he plays a real tough guy in that one, and you realize like he doesn't look all that different.
Uh-huh.
But it's just how he carries himself, and you realize, oh yeah, he's doing this perfectly, playing an everyman in Jaws, who is capable of stuff when he needs to. So,
well, yeah, and it was just so clever how they set up his flaws. He wasn't some tough cop, like he was scared I guess couldn't swim, or was at the very least scared of the water.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Which is a great little Achilles heel to throw in there.
Totally. It's so good.
So Robert Shaw, of course, played Quint. And it kind of occurred to me today that we never know what Quint's first name was. So I've always sort of thought that was interesting to wonder what I would put as his first name.
I don't know why. I've never really considered it.
He's just Quint.
Yeah, he's just a Quint. Yeah.
But Lee Marvin was originally going to play Quint. And Sterling Hayden was the other choice.
I don't know who that is.
Sterling Hayden, you saw Dr. Strangelove?
Oh, yeah.
He was General Ripper in Dr. Strangelove.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah.
And then Dreyfus, and apparently Dreyfus and Shaw were cast like a week before they started filming.
Oh, my God.
Which is crazy. But Dreyfus came in. John Voight was Spielberg's first choice, and then he didn't work out, and then he thought about Timothy Bottoms or Jeff Bridges. And, you know, now it's like with any film, once these people have these iconic characters, you can't imagine anyone else. But I think a young Jeff Bridges I could see as Matt Hooper.
I could too, except for, you know, Jeff Bridges is big and he can carry himself kind of big. And, you know, like he's handsome in a different way. And like there's something about the dynamic of Hooper and Quint.
Oh, yeah.
Where there's like alpha male, beta male sort of dynamic that is really important to that movie to me. And where they trade, you know, expertise and in different ways and try to one up each other. And then they come together in the, you know, in the scene where they're comparing scars and each of those actors, it could have worked, but it's so perfect the way it is, you know, but maybe it's because it's my first exposure. Like I didn't really know any of these actors, you know, because of my age, you know, but I knew them through this movie. And so, they're completely blank to me. Like maybe if I had seen Taken at Pelham 1, 2, 3 I'd probably seen Close Encounters, but you know, like I didn't have another, version of Dreyfus or, you know, Robert Shaw.
Yeah.
So this was the version that I had.
Well, and Hooper, as played by Dreyfus, was just such a goof. He wasn't afraid to make dumb jokes or to be silly. And like you said, definitely not the alpha male. Like in the introduction of those two characters, like Quince is probably the most obnoxious character introduction of all time, scratching his fingers across the chalkboard. And then you compare that to Hooper, who I don't know if you remember, but he steps up from the boat and he's like looking that other guy in the chest. He's so small and just goes, hello. And then goes, hello yourself. And he's just kind of goofy right off the bat. You know, he's not trying to be cool. He's not trying to one up anybody. He's, you know, he's a shark nerd.
Yeah. And you can tell he knows stuff because the way he uses vocabulary when he tells people, you know, to do different things, because Brody sort of instructs him to like, you know, so he knows like when he says, you know, those guys in the Fantail, blah, blah, blah. Like he knows the name of the boat, like exactly, you know, like they're never going to get out of the harbor alive. And he's like, this is what I'm talking about. Go out there, talk to these people. You know, like it's so, you know, he knows a lot, but he's not like lording it over people in any certain way. He just like the way that they use vocabulary is like so precise that he just, you know, he's smart. But he doesn't, you know, but he isn't like the most dominant person in the room until he gets to that autopsy or, you know, he's looking at it and he says, don't smoke in here. Thank you very much. And it's like, there's this moment. It's like, oh man, this guy's could be in charge, you know?
Yeah, that was a great scene. And another great example of restraint on the part of Spielberg to not, you know, these days he would, the first thing you would see in that scene would be a close-up shot of a mangled body of a woman. And I thought that you didn't see anything at all, but there is one kind of quick shot of the severed arm. But aside from that, the terror is listening to Dreyfuss very clinically describe the wounds on the body.
Yeah. I think the scariest part of the remains of the body are when it was found and it's covered in crabs. And that part really freaked me out.
Yeah.
Like crabs going through and eating it. Oh, God. Uh-huh. That is grim. That is grim.
So a minute ago, you talked about the scene, the very famous galley scene. And this is after they'd had their first encounter with the shark. And then they're drinking together. And this is when they really bond and kind of come together. And you have the scar comparing scene, which is one of the great, great exchanges in movies.
Right.
And Quint, you get a real sense here. Like he really takes in Hooper as his little, as his Gilligan to his skipper at that point.
Right.
You know,
it's really good.
It's kind of sweet.
It's really
almost
good. It is. It is. And it reminds me of people who I knew like that. Like my relatives are very Quint like in nature, you know, like they're very skeptical of people. They're very prone to stereotyping people. they're horrible in many, many respects. Most of them are dead now. But like, there's a way that, like any type of personal interaction that was meaningful, you could tell that it meant something to them and they could put aside all the other stuff as long as they could, you know, pick guitars with you and it would be, you know what I mean? Like there was something about and so that felt really nice and real. And his story of the Indianapolis is like, I have a hard time. Like I love radio so much.
Mm-hmm.
And, I love the storytelling in radio. It is still like my ideal form. And I think of Quint's story as the first radio story I ever really loved. It's like, it is told just perfectly. Like you could almost see it like, the StoryCorps music starts and then, you know, like on Morning Edition and then Quint just starts and you can remember some teenager going, oh my God, I can't believe it, you know, on the other side. And it's just like, it is a perfectly told, natural, I just think it's a radio story. I would cut it out and put it on the radio in a heartbeat. It's like perfect. And it's funny because there's all this stuff, all this great activity. You've already had the adventure music playing, you know, in the barrels and shooting it and everything. But that moment is so riveting. I love it. That's my favorite moment in the movie.
I mean, one of mine for sure. And, the backstory there for that scene was that that was not in the book. And Spielberg brought in the great screenwriter and filmmaker John Milius to write that monologue. And then apparently Robert Shaw himself, too, who was a playwright, went in and did some rewriting on it and kind of worked with Milius on it. And, you know, just ends up being like one of the most iconic monologues in movie history for sure.
Oh, it is so good. And it so naturally moves into, you know, from one scene to the scar comparing scene to the other.
Uh-huh.
And the fact that I've thought about this a lot, it's like, because it gets called out because they're comparing scars and Brody says, what's that on your arm? And it's the removal of the tattoo of the Indianapolis.
Right.
And I think about that all the time. Like, why would he remove it?
Yeah.
You know, and like what was going on in his head that he would remove it, instead of keep it there. And with every part of his character that you get in other ways, that seems like this extreme moment in his life that you have no knowledge of, but you just have this little tiny peek into. And I love that part of it too. It's just
so for good. Sure. I never really thought about that. That is super interesting that he would, and that's, like old sailors don't have tattoos removed, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So like the level of trauma or whatever he was trying to get away from or whatever it was, like it was clearly something that haunted him. in a way, like it was not an adventure story to him.
Yeah.
What happened. And, or maybe, you know, maybe it was just something else. Like you don't really know. It's an incomplete narrative, but I've tried to fill that in my head lots of times and I've never come up with like what I think is the answer, but it mainly has to do with him trying to get away from it and his willingness to talk about it at that moment. I think it points to how close he's gotten in this short amount of time, but also that he senses the peril that they're in and wants them to be really aware of what's about to happen and what's about to happen. Like happens almost immediately afterward. Like they start, you know, the shark starts knocking into the boat.
Yeah.
In the next scene. So.
Yeah. It's funny. And I never really thought about it, but it's almost like Quint knows this is the last time I'm going to tell this story.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
That scene also has, another line that I obnoxiously quote that no one ever gets. But a lot of times when, someone will toast a drink, I'll say, let's drink to our legs. And everyone's always like, what? What the hell are you talking about?
I would get it.
All right. Yeah. Well, I'll toast you that way next time I see you.
Excellent.
All right. Well, I guess let's move on to the ending of the movie. I didn't want to go through this all piece by piece, but I think we've done a good job of kind of covering the main sections. Sure. But you have to talk about the end because there is plenty of foreshadowing that tank is going to play a part. But again, it is so well-crafted and subtly done. It never, ever feels like you're being hit over the head like you feel these days, like when you see the gun in Act 1, it's going to go off in Act 3. You see that tank in Act 1. In the little picture, remember when he's flipping through the book, there's a photograph of a shark with a tank in his mouth. And then midway, you hear Dreyfus has a line about when the tanks get loose, like, you know, those things can blow up. But you still don't feel like – I never put the two together when I was first seeing that movie for the first time.
No.
You know?
Not at all. That's really well done. I mean, it's just perfect foreshadowing. And you don't exactly know. Well, I mean, you think it's probably one of the things I'd like is the moment when Quint realizes that they're in real trouble and he's like, okay, so Hooper, what is this stuff you're going to do? And, you know, lets him try it.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, you know, work obviously, but, and you think that maybe that's the payoff of it all. You know, that's why they're reminding you of the high tech gear.
Right.
Yeah, it totally is used, somewhat differently. I think I have also, in addition to sharks inside of pools, I have a huge fear of compressed air.
Oh, really?
I am terrified of compressed air. I used to, when I lived in Athens in grad school, when I was leaving, I used to work in the warehouse at Sears at the mall, and I'd have to move around these big red compressed air containers for, you know, people buy them to, you know, put their, you know, put air in their John Deere tractors or something. Uh-huh. And I hated it because I just feel like they're going to blow up any minute, you know, which are totally not true. they're totally fine. But I think I might be because of Jaws that I have a fear of compressed air too. I hate filling, air on my tires.
Uh-huh. Cause you think the tire's going to blow up in your face?
I totally think the tire's going to blow up in my face. I hate it. Hate it.
That's very funny. That's very brave of you to admit this, Roman.
Yeah, it's a real problem. But yeah, the foreshadowing. I mean, I don't love the ending. You know, like it's so over the top as compared to the rest of it. But it's so like it earns it. It earned anything. Like if a spaceship came down, it would earn it to me. You know? So I'm okay with it. It's funny, like this time I really paid attention to, the fact that, Brody is muttering to himself his plan, you know, when he's about to take the shot or put the thing, like he knows what he's doing, even though it's like filmed, like it could have been a little bit more accidental or just, you know, just improvisational, but he's, you know, he's really, you know, he has an idea and, It's interesting to watch it pay off and have it work. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, the true terror of that movie is like the last 8 minutes. you know, and it is over the top. And very famously, you know, the shark didn't work well. The mechanical shark Bruce didn't work well. So Spielberg had to kind of redo the story. But initially, you know, it was going to be way more of a horror movie, like a Saturday afternoon kind of B movie style horror movie. And Spielberg admits, and everyone, you know, is sort of agreed over the years that it was a godsend. That he was forced to be a little more creative and teasing the shark out. But I think deep down, like, he was like, all right, but I've got to, like, the Quint death has to be the money shot. And it's just so over the top and terrifying and gory and awful. It's just kind of perfect almost.
It is. I totally, that one, that part is kind of fine to me. Like, it just gives you the idea of this is a monster. In a new way, rather than just like it's not a thing of nature at this point anymore. It's a real monster. And so that part I like, cause the thing's going down, it kind of happens a little bit in slow motion and Quint's fighting to the end. He has like a machete, like right below the shark's eyeball.
I know. You know?
And it is really, really great. I mean, I think that my favorite part of the ending is there's like a wide shot of the boat tipped over and Brody is in the crow's nest.
Yeah.
And at this angle, and it's just beautiful. It's just like, it is a gorgeous shot. And you know, he has just a little bit of time before he's just submerged. Like, that is not a good place to be.
That was a terrifying shot.
I just think it's, I think the shots in the ocean are just gorgeous, but that's my favorite, is that side is like with the, is it's at a, I don't know, maybe like a 30 degree angle off of being completely submerged. It's just gorgeous.
And then of course the shark dies, explodes. And then, from underwater, you see the shark coming apart and falling away. Mm-hmm. And that beautiful, like, tinkling score from John Williams comes in. And all of a sudden, like, this little bit of a pang for the shark comes up. Somehow, for me at least, where you kind of feel bad for this thing.
I just feel like his reaction is so exuberant, you know, like, and he's in this real struggle with this creature, and it was, you know, very unlikely to work. And so, I guess I do get it a little bit, but I think I'm very much more on Brody's side. And so I'm like, cool with it. The one thing I do think all the time is like, well, there's going to be a bunch of more sharks that are going to show up because this thing is bleeding in the water and they need to get out of there really fast. That part always makes me nervous. It's never, it's not hinted at all or expect it to happen. But yeah, that I always think about that.
Well, and when they're kicking back to shore with the seagulls, there's like hundreds and hundreds of seagulls. I always remember the first times I watched it being like, kick faster, boys, kick faster.
And Hooper shows up and it's so harrowing up to that point that you do kind of forget about him.
Yeah.
Legitimately. So it doesn't feel like a weird, you know, just like a trick at the end that he comes back.
So. Yeah, and you know, the only problem I have with this entire movie is if it were me, I would not have shown Hooper getting away and hiding behind the rocks when he got out of the shark cage. I would have left it a little more like you thought he was dead and then surprise he's not. But that maybe have been too hokey, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it would play either way. I think I needed it. I think I needed it so that it didn't feel like a weird, you know, Carrie, you know, coming out of the grave at the end of Carrie type of thing. Like I think I appreciate the guidance there. Spielberg personally.
All right. So, these last two segments, one is called What Ebert Said.
This movie is a complete disappointment.
Roger Ebert, my favorite film critic of all time. I like to go back and just read a quick little piece from his reviews. You'll be pleased to know that Ebert gave Jaws 4 stars, max rating, and ostensibly a thumbs up. And here's his quote. The screenplay by Spielberg, Benchley, and Carl Gottlieb, with contributions by Howard Sackler and a crucial speech by Shaw, does not twist itself into parables. The characters all have straightforward motivations. A little dialogue goes a long way. Individual lines stand out for hard-edged terseness. The cinematography by Bill Butler is at pains to tell the story in the midst of middle-class America. If Spielberg's favorite location would become the suburbs, Jaws was suburbanites on vacation.
Hmm. Wow. That's good.
Yeah.
Hey, that's good. I know what he's doing.
And then if you have a couple more minutes, we like to finish out Movie Crush with five questions for Roman. Yeah. And these can just be quick answers. And this is just a little bit about your film going history. First movie you remember seeing in the theater?
Yeah, Blue Lagoon.
That's a great one. That's not going to forget that.
Yeah.
First R-rated movie you saw, whether in the theater or at home?
That would be Blue Lagoon too. I think, right? Was that R-rated?
I guess it probably was.
The other one I remember really early on VHS was The Shining. I saw really young, and it really threw me off.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Lord, Roman.
No.
Who were your parents, for God's sakes?
they were working hard. My I had a single mom, so she worked hard in other ways. And so, I was on my, to my own devices.
That has its good and its bad sides, I guess.
Exactly.
Question three, will you walk out of a bad movie? And if so, what was the last one?
I've only walked out once. I walked out of a movie called Malice, which is
Alec Baldwin?
Alec Baldwin. And I just found it, I was in college at Oberlin, and I hate everything. I hate every moment of these people. And I had to get out of there. I just felt gross. So I left.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oberlin, man. You're like the fourth person I know from Oberlin.
It's a good place.
Yeah. All right. So number four, do you have a movie you can think of that is a guilty pleasure movie for you?
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like I work so much. I have so few pleasures that I
can't indulge
guilty
ones.
About them.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you were to say, like, is there a movie I like that's probably uncharacteristic for a person who's like a 42-year-old man to like?
Uh-huh.
Like, I really appreciate the movie Bring It On. I think it's really well made. I mean, I think that I saw that a couple of times and I was like, that's a well-made movie. And then Pitch Perfect, which is exactly the same movie.
Yeah.
And you could watch them side by side. And I think the story beats happen exactly the same. They're exactly the same. Just like the details are changed.
Right.
And so I appreciate those two movies. My weird thing with movies is sometimes I don't watch my favorite movies very often. I tend to watch movies I kind of like, more often, like they're unchallenging that I put on. So like my one for this for a long time was Gross Point Blank, which is not a movie. It's not a movie I think is all that good.
Right.
And I think that part of my mind is trying to resolve the things I like about it and how I would improve it or something. Like there's a puzzle to it.
Yeah.
So I sometimes watch movies that are not my favorite movies over and over again, which seems like a ridiculous waste of time at this point.
I like that. That's interesting. And final question here, sort of a movie going 101 with Roman Mars. What's your movie ritual? I know you don't get out much, but when you do go out to a movie, do you have a preferred seat? Do you get the same thing at the concession stand every time? Do you have any rituals?
I do. I tend to go early. When I'm by myself, I'll go early and I'll bring something to read. And I like to go to movies by myself or with my two kids.
Uh-huh.
And so I am not like I do things by myself all the time. So movies are one of those things I actually kind of like to do alone, because I'm not one of those people that likes to like during the credits, like turn to someone and say, so what do you think? You know,
right.
Like, I'm not that guy. That's not my thing. So I like to just kind of live in it.
Yeah.
And so that would be my ritual. And I'm kind of like I'm a center, a little more forward than, you know, like, to the front than most people tend to like. Like I'd like the first row of the second, tier of, and cause I also like to get, be able to get out. Like I don't know. And I, you know, I like to go early and I can't be late and you know, all that sort of stuff. Like I don't like to rush. So those would be my general rituals. And then the tendency to go alone. Like a movie is like not something to me that I like the collective energy of a room for something like, a horror movie like Get Out or a comedy. But I don't need like personal friends to be with me. Right.
You love to be surrounded by strangers and share an experience with people you don't know.
Exactly.
I love it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks, man.
My pleasure.
I appreciate it. This has been a good one.
Oh, thanks. That's so nice. I like talking to you about this stuff. So
yeah. And
I appreciate you thinking of me.
Of course, everyone check out 99% Invisible and what's it called? What Trump Can Teach Us About Con Law.
Yep. That's two.
And
two
just
shows.
The whole Radiotopia Network. You pick a show and it's going to be great. I guarantee it.
Yeah. Me too. I guarantee it.
All right. Thanks, Roman.
Thank you, Chuck. I appreciate it.
Wow. So that was just wonderful. What a great chat with Roman Mars about Jaws. I think it was pretty clear that both of us are just super fans of that movie. So that was a lot of fun for me. I felt like, geez, we probably could have sat down for 3 hours and broken that movie apart piece by piece and really wonked out on it. So, hope we didn't do that too much for you non-Jaws fanatics, but, that was a lot of fun for me and it seemed like Roman had a good time. And in his case, it seemed like, we'll chalk this one up to general artistry. It seems like his appreciation for Jaws, very much was about, just how well crafted, the movie was and the direction and the editing and the music. And the pacing, the acting, he seemed to really, really be interested in just what a fine example of filmmaking that Jaws was. So it wasn't really nostalgia or have anything personal for him. He's not an ichthyologist, as far as I know. It was interesting to hear about his fear of compressed air. Never heard that one. I don't know if there's a real phobia. Maybe we could call it Romophobia or something. We could make it up. But good dude, great talk, and hope we illuminated a little bit for you Jaws fans out there, a little bit more about the movie. Just had a lot of fun with that one. So we'll see you next time, and until then, would it kill you to share some M&Ms? You guys have a good week. Movie Crush is produced, edited, engineered, and scored by Noel Brown from our podcast studio at Pond City Market, Atlanta, Georgia.